Okay, everybody can hear me? Is there a paper towel, maybe? So, thanks. Good morning. My name is Gary Alley. Some of you might know me, some of you maybe not. And I've been here 20 years. I came here with the Southern Baptist to work on this property as a journeyman, is what I was called, the program. And it's pretty amazing to think I'm still here. My parents are here visiting. They've been a few times, and I know they were not expecting me to be here 20 years. But that's why our God is unfathomable. His ways are not our ways. And so let's start. Blessed are the tired and worn, for they will have rest. Blessed are the weak and sick, for they will become strong. Blessed are the depressed and downcast, for they will discover hope. Blessed are those lost and stumbling, for they will eventually find the right path. Blessed are the angry and frustrated, for they will acquire joy. Blessed are those who chronically suffer, for they will be healed. Blessed are the addicts, for they will be free. Blessed are the sinners, for they will be forgiven. Blessed are the losers, for they will win. Everything about Jesus' kingdom of heaven does not make sense. It's ironic. The last will be first. The first will be last. So-called sinners enter while the apparently religious are left out. Weakness is more valuable than strength. Power is a stumbling block. Humility is the invitation. Leaders serve and servants lead. Enemies are to be loved and family and friends are to be hated. And in the kingdom of heaven, the poor become rich and the criminal is forgiven because the king is crucified. Now, you might say those are extreme, shocking statements taken out of context, bad biblical interpretation. God is not ironic. Well, my life is ironic. As we grow older, our life experiences have shown us what reality is. Selfish, childish mistakes, repeated lifestyle choices, calcified patterns of behavior, and ultimately a hardened heart. Yet Jesus' kingdom inverts our earthly expectations. Sometimes God shines a light in our personal abyss. I waited patiently for the Lord. He inclined unto me. He heard my cry. He brought me up out of the pit, out of the miry clay. He set my feet upon a rock. He made my footsteps firm. He put a new song in my mouth, a song of praise to our God. Psalm 40. The word here in Hebrew for pit is bor, which can also be translated as cistern, a place where water is collected. You'll recall the story of Joseph when his brothers threw him into a cistern. It says they threw him into a bor. And in Genesis 37, it says, there was no water in that bor, that pit. But often there would be water in a bor, just like you would have for drinking at that time. Or at least there'd be the muddy remains of the water in the bor, the pit. Sometimes God lifts us out of that pit that we're in. And yet the mud still sticks to us. Sometimes God lifts us out of our mess, a mess that we made ourselves, or a mess that was given to us at birth, or a mess that someone dragged us into, or a mess that we accidentally walked into. It doesn't really matter what your mess is. If you're in a mess, you're in a mess. And the point is, you want to get out of your mess. Your mess could be sickness. Your mess could be broken relationships. Your mess could be an undisciplined and listless life, laziness. Your mess could be your bad attitude. Your mess could be your finances. Your mess could be your depression. Your mess could be simply your sin. Your mess could be that you're just a loser. Or at least you think you're a loser for any of the reasons given above. I don't know about you, but my life is a mess. And I need God to put a new song in my mouth, a song of praise. Former pastor and teacher Mike Iaconelli, who passed away 12 years ago, wrote a book called Messy Spirituality. He says, "We've been bombarded with books, tapes, talks, seminars, and movies convincing us that real Christianity is all about perfection. But real Christianity is messy, erratic, lopsided, but gloriously liberating. The way of the spiritual life begins where we are now in the mess of our lives," he continues. "Accepting the reality of our broken, flawed lives is the beginning of spirituality. Not because the spiritual life will remove our flaws, but because we let go of seeking perfection, and instead we seek God, the one who is present in the tangledness of our lives." Listen to this. He ends with, "Spirituality is not about being fixed. It's about God being present in the mess of our unfixedness." Again, irony. We need a new song in our mouths, a song of praise. Most of us here this morning will agree with me. We would mostly, all of us, say we're not perfect. It's very much part of our Protestant mantra, right? Saved by faith, not by works. Say it with me. Saved by faith, not by works. We acknowledge that we are sinners. Calvin and, you know, there's a litany of our Protestant forefathers that have beat that into us. Luther. We say we are imperfect, but in the back of our minds, there's this occasional nagging, call it guilt, where we may feel like we fall short of God's calling in our lives. Where is His healing? Where is that change in my life? Where is His power? Instead, all we see is mediocrity and brokenness. But when I am weak, I am strong. I will boast most gladly about my weaknesses, so that the power of Christ may reside in me. 2 Corinthians 12. Again, that irreconcilable irony. When I am weak, I am strong. When we are weak, we are strong. So I'm going to tell you a story. When I was in high school in Florida, that's where I grew up, I was involved in a Christian organization called FCA, Fellowship of Christian Athletes, which ideally was a group made up of Christians who were also athletes. But our group in our high school was tiny. There was maybe 20 or 30 people in this club. Other clubs would have hundreds, 200 kids. Ours was quite small. While most in our group were probably Christians, very few were athletes. You see, at my school, it was not cool to be an athlete and a Christian. Now, there were Christians who were athletes, but they never came to our meetings. So at the end of the day, I was the president of this so-called Christian athlete club. Granted, I like to play sports, but I wasn't an awesome athlete. I'd like to think of myself as kind of average on a high end of the scale in my perspective, but it's probably lower. In fact, I didn't play a sport at my high school until my senior year when I started to feel guilty that I was president of this Christian athlete club, and I went out for football. And I made the team, but I sat the bench. I was on the defensive line, so I was a runt. we were tackling dummies that, you know, could breathe. Okay, so the story is this. One time we had our meeting, and the top pitcher of our baseball team of the high school came to the meeting. He was the ace. And he came with another one of his cool friends. I thought, wow, what's he doing here? I didn't even know he was a Christian. At the end of our meeting, the teacher who ran the meeting was talking about how we need to show that we're willing to demonstrate how we love Jesus. So he wanted us to show our love for Jesus by coming up and giving him a hug. And I was sitting there thinking, are you kidding? You know, get this baseball player here. He's cool. And it's hard enough to try to get people like that here. And now we got to go give hugs in front of everyone. But I was the president. So I went up and gave the teacher a hug. And, you know, the cool baseball player never came back, needless to say. And that memory has always been seared in my mind this whole time. But I think it's a microcosm for following Jesus. As a youth, it was one of the most uncool things I ever did. But I believe God has called us to be uncool, to go against the grain, to swim against the flow, to accept our loserness in the world's eyes, so that we can have God do great things in our own lives. We need a new song in our mouths, a song of praise. Now I want to give a living parable about what I'm speaking about this morning. I want to talk about us, Narkee Street Congregation. How many people here would say you are a member of this congregation? Raise your hand. Okay, I'm counting like maybe 20, 25. And the rest might be visitors, short term. Okay, well, if you're a member here, you know any of our history, you might call us a mess as well. So all you visitors, welcome to our mess. First off, we have quite a few weirdos who come here. People have problems, and we don't even realize we have problems. Some you might even call sinners, addicts, beggars will be roaming outside of us, causing problems every so often. And so Jerusalem just attracts these type of people anyway. So we're a bit odd. Also, we're kind of a strange group to be here in Jerusalem in Israel. I would call us an alien life form, our congregation, because we're speaking English. This whole country speaks Hebrew or Arabic for the most part. There's a significant Russian population, but for the most part, it's Hebrew and Arabic. And so we don't fit within a lot of boxes that are a part of this country. The new government was just elected. Well, it was elected a while ago, but it was finally formed this week. I guarantee you no one in the Knesset is thinking about us. We're not going to be part of their plans for coming up with a fair government. So we're aliens here. Obviously, we have some Israelis here, some that have gone to Israeli schools. They went into the army, and they're as much Israeli as Israeli could be. But besides that, the rest of us, not so much. This congregation's more international. And often short-term, people will be here for a couple years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years. I've been here 20 years. I still kind of consider myself short-term. And on top of that, the Christians in this country, the majority, are Eastern Christians. They come from the East, not from the West. This is a Western-based congregation, evangelical, which ultimately goes back to the West. And again, the Eastern Christians probably think of us as bizarre. We are just different and weird. So, and then finally, let's talk about a little history. Our congregation was formed 90 years ago. From the 1920s into the 1960s, we would average between 20 and 30 members at the service. That's kind of like this morning. But in the 1970s, the numbers began increasing. Most people attribute that to the charismatic renewal that was sweeping the world at that time. Who was here when that was happening in Narkeese? Can you raise your hand? Okay, so now we're really getting down to about 10 people maybe. The chapel was out in that grass there, and it was originally built to hold about 60 people. And because of the numbers that are coming in, they had to start tearing down walls and kind of like a redneck garage, if you know the American term. You kind of knock the walls down, and it's not a real unified building. You just start adding little spaces out. And that's how the chapel was growing. And you ultimately had about 200 people meeting out there around the chapel, in the chapel. 1982, during the Feast of Tabernacles, there was a great fire, an arson set a fire here. It destroyed the chapel. How many people knew about that? Have you heard about that? So you who knew Dwight, you never heard about that. Okay. This was a big event. It was around the world, international news, because here you have a Christian place of worship in a Jewish land being destroyed by fire, which brought back memories for many Jews here of Kristallnacht in Germany, when Jewish places of worship were destroyed by fire, and throughout history. So this place really got big. There were 300 and 400 people coming. There was a tent that met here in the parking lot for about 9 years because of trying to get permits to build. That was in the '80s. And finally, this sanctuary is built in 1991. Okay, I show up here in 1995, 4 years later. At that time, from my memory, there was probably about 200 people who were coming to the services. But in the last few years, if you look around here, we rarely have 100, unless there's a tour group here or something. Now, did you notice how I just described our church history by using numbers? I want to read something to you. Okay, this is a funny guy, but you'll figure it out. Evangelicals are highly competitive about church size. Some churches calculate their size by the number of people who attend on Sunday morning. Others count all the people they touch, in quotes, in any given week, including those visited in the hospital, those sent bulk mailings, and those prayed for. It is easy for a church of 100 to claim thousands of members by spreading itself around a bit. Baptist churches are particularly adept at this. They define a member as any person alive or dead who visited the church once in the past 30 years. And you might have other churches that you come from like that as well. So, say you meet someone. This is a book for people who want to know what evangelicals think. And he's saying, this is from How to Talk and Act Like an Evangelical Without Being One. So, say you meet someone, and they say, tell me about your church. Or you say, tell me about your church. It should be construed as a mannerly way of asking how large your church is. Size matters to evangelicals, but because you don't really attend church, your church can be as large as you want. Here are some tips. Avoid saying you belong to a mini church. If you make this mistake, be prepared to answer for why you still attend that church. Perhaps it was planted by a mega church or by an exciting leader, which will make you seem like a pioneer. Perhaps it went through a recent church split, which means the devil has been at work and you are working hard to regain lost ground. But if you have no good explanation for attending a church so small, you may be seen as staying in your comfort zone and not doing enough for the Lord. After all, many churches can't mount significant evangelism efforts or mission trips unless they have a wealthy benefactor. And the only reason a wealthy benefactor stays with a mini church is because he is getting a kick out of controlling the pastor. Rather than get into messy discussions of this sort and avoid saying you belong to a mini church. And one other thing, I mentioned Mike Iaconelli, who wrote this book on messy spirituality. He was a pastor, and this is how he describes his church. I pastor the slowest growing church in America. We started 12 years ago with 90 members and have ungrown to 30. We are about as far as you can get from a user-friendly church. Not because our congregation is unfriendly, but because our services are unpredictable, unpolished, and inconsistent. We are an odd, friendly church, attracting unique and different followers of Christ who make every service a surprise. In a way, I think that kind of describes us. Because this every week we have all kinds of people up here who do the Parashah, the New Testament, the announcements, people doing the sermon. You never know exactly who's going to be up here. And so if you think I'm one of those odd people, you have every right to think that. Now, this coming week, there's going to be a huge conference here in Jerusalem. Have you heard about it? Empowered 21? It's advertised as the largest Christian gathering in Jerusalem in modern history. Thousands are coming. And then this was the tagline. All spirit-empowered Christians from every nation of the world are implored to join this historic Congress in Jerusalem, the birthplace of the outpouring of the Holy Spirit. Have an authentic experience with God's presence that will ignite your faith and change your life forever. That's pretty good marketing, huh? I think it's human nature to compare. And it would be easy to say God is at work somewhere and God is not at work somewhere else. We often compare things based on empirical evidence or numbers, which is the result of us trying to measure growth. And so we say, this place is alive, this place is dead. This place is spirit-filled, and this place is not so much. But we should be careful to judge the things of the Spirit. God's Spirit does not play by our rules. We should remember that some of Jesus' parables, which describe the kingdom of heaven, describe the kingdom of heaven as small things, things that cannot be measured by the flesh. Story of the sower. How is the kingdom? It's coming in seed. Seed is small. The other parable of the wheat and the tares. Weeds are sowed among the wheat, and they grow up together. And only at harvest do you see the difference between the two. The parable of the pearl, selling all to buy this little tiny thing. The story of the treasure, it's buried in the ground. It's a small thing. The parable of the mustard seed that grows into this huge tree, but it's this tiny little black seed. The parable of the yeast or the leaven. You can't even see it. It floats in from the air. All these parables describe the kingdom of heaven as small things, hidden things, things that are hard to measure. Sure, they talk about his kingdom growing in a supernatural way, but that's the point. God does the growing. We cannot force God's hand. We cannot write a book explaining how to grow his kingdom. And therefore, we cannot assume God's plan. So we need to be sensitive to his Spirit. I want to end with a recent article written in The Guardian by Giles Frazier. He wrote this, it came out at Easter time. Maybe you saw it. I'm just going to take a couple of quotes from it. When Jesus was nothing but a suspended carcass, dripping with his own blood and other people's spit, there were no worshipers around clapping their hands and singing their hymns. They were long gone. At the very end, ironically, at the moment of greatest triumph, he had no followers left. That says something profoundly counterintuitive about what a successful church looks like. For if the core of the Christian message, death first, then resurrection, is so existentially full on that nobody can possibly endure it, then a church that successfully proclaims that message is likely to be empty and not full. Which is also why, quite possibly, a successful priest ought to be hated rather than feted. For here, as elsewhere in the Christian story, success and failure are inverted. The first will be last and the last first. The rich are cast down and the poor are exalted. The true king is crowned with mockery and thorns, not with gold and ermine. And then he ends with this. In a world where we semaphore our successes to each other at every possible opportunity, I'd call that good marketing, churches cannot be blamed for failing to live up to this austere and wonderful message. The worst of them judge their success in entirely worldly terms by counting their followers. Their websites show images of happy, uncomplicated people doing good, improving stuff in the big community. But if I am right about the meaning of Christ's passion, then a church is at its best when it fails, when it gives up on all the ecclesiastical glitter, when the weeds start to break through the floor. I love that image. And when it shows others that failure is absolutely nothing of the sort. Let's be reminded that it's not about us, it's about Him. All to Jesus I surrender, all to Him I freely give. In the midst of our sin, suffering, and sadness, He is there. He is the focus, not our mess. We are on a path of spiritual growth, even if it's a muddy path. And it is a muddy path. There is much to learn as we continually make mistakes. Even if the pit is dark and dirty, we can't give up on God. He's there. Let's become more humble, more gentle, and more thankful. He will put a new song in our mouth, a song of praise. Blessed are the tired and worn, for they will have rest. Blessed are the weak and sick, for they will become strong. Blessed are the depressed and downcast, for they will discover hope. Blessed are those lost and stumbling, for they will eventually find the right path. Blessed are the angry, the frustrated, for they will acquire joy. Blessed are those who chronically suffer, for they will be healed. Blessed are the addicts, for they will be free. Blessed are the sinners, for they will be forgiven. Blessed are the losers, for they will win.